Got my coffee in my Harry Potter cup. I hope that's acceptable to everybody. There will be no expecto patronums from the stage today. Someone's going to come tell me I didn't say that right after this is over. Okay, well, we are just about at the finish line of our discussion on anxiety. I think that we'll end up having to close. Could not be the case, but I believe that we'll end up having to finish next time we're together, close things out, because I would rather work these in as opposed to try to rush through them, just because some of this stuff is so important, and worry and fear are so challenging and so real. So let's get into it. I'm going to try to go as far as I can today responsibly. We started off just talking about our time, addressing the anxiety, worry, fear with the promises and nature of God. Talked about who God is, what he has promised, what he has done, what he is going to do as a foundation for pushing back against fear and worry. But then we reached a sticking point, and that sticking point, we said, was where, hey, I believe the promises and the nature of God. I know all these things, and yet, despite knowing all of those things, I still struggle mightily with fear, with worry, with anxiety. Last time, we tried to move past the sticking point by working within the formula. And if you recall, the formula is valuables plus hostile world plus impotence. And we talked about looking at each component of those things in cases of fear and worry and challenging what we believe about ourselves, God, and the world and in each area. So if you missed that, please go back and look at it. And I think it's important to answer this question, because someone could say, why bother with going through valuables, hostile world, impotence? Why don't you just go straight to the promises of God? Why not just forget that and just go straight to them? And let me tell you why. It's because there are some times where people end up trusting God to deliver them from emergencies that don't actually exist. I mean, they're having radical faith that God's going to radically show up for a situation that really isn't even happening. So if we're trying to believe the truth about ourselves, God, and the world, it's gracious to point out to somebody in these areas, whether that's, hey, this is not as dangerous as it seems, hey, you're not as impotent as you seem, hey, this and that, and so that there's not really something that is so threatening. But we reach that second sticking point. And that second sticking point was, there are times in this world where things I value are truly threatened and I am impotent and unable to take meaningful action. I can't really do anything about it. It's almost totally outside my control. And when all of those three things happen to come together, and don't let someone just jump down to this first. Don't let yourself jump down to this first. Everyone thinks that all of their anxiety and worry is a case of one of these, when in fact it's not. Sometimes it can be. When all those things come together, I struggle so mightily with crippling anxiety. Maybe it's not crippling. Maybe it's lower grade, but for some people it certainly is. And here's the thing. It's a reality in the world that we live in. Occasionally, this is going to happen. Occasionally, those three things are going to come together. And you ask, Tyler, what do you have for me now, so to speak? I want to briefly talk about the idea of unbelief. Ben Ward actually brought this up in, I think, the very first session that we did on this, where we talked about not believing the promises and the nature of God, believing them, but I'm still struggling with worry. And the idea was, to what degree do we really believe these things? And I had a conversation, I can't remember, maybe it was with Matt Taylor, I can't remember, right after the Sunday school last week, that was talking about, do we really, really believe that God is this, or that God promises this, and yet still worry and have anxiety and such? And I think the answer is yes and no. And I want to introduce a somewhat artificial distinction that a philosopher, Stephen T. Davis, introduces between believing something and accepting something. Because sometimes we believe the promises of God like someone with claustrophobia believes that crowded elevators are safe. Okay? They believe it, like they assent to it. Okay, I know that in the end of the day, it is safe to get on a crowded elevator. Okay? However, they don't accept it, and the distinction there that Davis makes is it's not a belief that has any impact in driving their life. It's something they assent to the truth of, but they act as if, they live as if it were true, that it were, that, that elevators were dangerous. They're not going to get on. Well, if it's safe, why don't you, I can't bring myself, I understand at a certain level that it's okay, and that even that this is irrational, but that's what's going to draw. I'm just going to wait for the next one. Now, of course, maybe you get to a point where it's just preference, okay? And we're talking about a different issue then. But the idea is we can certainly believe something at one level, whatever you want to call it. If you don't buy the belief, accept distinction, fair enough. But I can believe something at one level, but it's believing it at a level that doesn't work into my daily life. It's believing at a level that doesn't change anything about what I do. It doesn't change anything about the way I feel. It's the most superficial level of belief possible. And to that extent, how do you help someone? Well, I think that's what we're going to see today. I think what you do is you take them into the scripture and you show them examples and principles flowing from those truths, the nature and promises of God. Because brothers and sisters, you don't go, there's nothing deeper than those. It's not like, oh wait, here's the deep stuff. You started out with like the easy stuff and now it's the deep stuff. You don't go deeper than the promises of God and the nature of God. It doesn't get any deeper expressed in the gospel. So what do? You help show people examples, illustrations. You give them concrete pictures of God's mercy. And that's how you help people move past the second sticking point. That's what we're going to discuss today. Before I dive into that, are there any remaining questions from last time we were together that I can clarify, anything that was communicated poorly that I have a chance to clarify or elaborate on? Okay, great. Well, what I want to start off with is what I believe to be the single most foundational, most helpful expression of God's grace in Scripture as a tool for helping people with worry. If I had to pick one, I think this would be it. So I'm okay with spending some time on it here. And this is what I'm calling, oh, this is backwards. So, oh boy. Hold on. There it is. We're going to go backwards, y'all. This is what I call the manna principle. The manna principle from Exodus 16, 9 through 19. If you recall, the Israelites have come out of Egypt. They're wandering in the wilderness. They're trying to get to, they're getting to Mount Sinai. People of God are grumbling because things were different back then. That was a joke. And they said, why can we just die in Egypt? If we're going to die out here, we could have just died in Egypt. Why do you bring us out here? You know, at least back there we had food and all the rest. That's what Moses says. Then Moses said to Aaron in chapter 16, verse 9, say to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling. And as soon as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, I have heard the grumbling of the people of Israel. Say to them, you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God. In the evening, quail came up and covered the camp, and in the morning dew lay around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as frost on the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? Which is, of course, what the word manna means, right? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, each one of you, as much as he can. You shall each take an omer according to the number of the persons that each of you has in his tent. And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less, but they measured it with an omer. Whoever gathered much had nothing left over. Whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as he could eat. Okay? So here's the picture that we so clearly get. As an example of God's grace. God only gives grace, so to speak, for today. Tomorrow's grace will only come tomorrow. I just This is a big deal. This has the potential, if you can really grasp this, to change everything, okay? God gives us enough to provide for our need and even more for today. However, after that, more need will come. There needs to be provision for tomorrow. There needs to be new mercies. And thankfully, his mercies are new every morning. Think about it. If you don't need new mercies for a new morning, why can't you just say God is merciful? So this is more than just a generic promise to trust God. I want to kind of unwrap this here, because what it's giving is an insight into the shape of that trust. It's giving an insight into the shape of that trust. Here's an example of how God graciously provides for his people in a way that forces dependence on him. Forces dependence on him, because there's none left after the day. One author talking about this passage says this. He says, of course, the plan is ingenious. By only giving enough provision for the day, dependence on God for tomorrow was always front and center. Let them put a year's supply of manna in cold storage, and they would forget about God for 364 days, and so would we. Wow. So how does this relate to anxiety then? How does this relate to worry? Anxiety attempts to imagine tomorrow's challenges and sorrows with only today's grace. Anxiety and worry is living in the future, because remember, we say that although it's anxiety is experienced in the present, it's something that is future-oriented. But you can't experience God's provision for tomorrow today. It's only going to come tomorrow. Worry and anxiety is when you're sitting there after dinner realizing there's no more manna left and looking to tomorrow saying, how are we going to get through? We have an empty manna basket. It's not tomorrow yet. That's when God refills the manna basket, so to speak, in this example for the Israelites. I guess we'll have to trust God to show up afresh tomorrow. And I want you to notice, I mean, look, this is tailored here, isn't it? Some people got a lot, some people a little. Everyone ended up for that day the right amount for them, for that family. Nothing more. You get customized grace. An example here, but only when tomorrow comes. So worrying about tomorrow's potential devastation, apart from tomorrow's grace, that's like worrying about the root canal that I'm going to have to get in a week because I don't have a Novocaine shot now. That doesn't come until then. See how much sense, it doesn't make any sense, right? If someone were to say, I'm worried about it because I can still feel my tooth right now, someone would say, wait a second, it's a week out. That only comes then, not now. And so I want to suggest that that's the case with God's grace. And here's an example right here. I think where God provides graciously for his people, sustains them, on a daily basis, such that it forces dependence. Now, here's the thing. Some of you are thinking about what tomorrow might look like, or what that challenge may look like, or losing that job may look like, or losing somebody may look like. And you might say, I can't imagine the kind of sustaining grace that might come with the devastation of tomorrow. Here's the thing. Neither can anyone else. Thankfully, God's providence isn't limited to our imagination. Tomorrow, I am going to be thrown into, I'm going to be burned alive tomorrow. I'm going to be put into a literal fire tomorrow. I can't imagine what kind of grace could show up there that would meaningfully assuage my worry. Well, let's look at an example from the Bible. And we're not all going to be Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But let's talk about this example, because here are three guys who weren't thrown into the fire, figuratively speaking. They were literally thrown in to the fire. In Daniel chapter 3, I'm not going to read the entire passage just for the sake of time, but the basic idea is this. King Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the Babylonians, has erected this enormous golden statue. And he says that, listen, hey, everyone's going to worship this. And anyone who's kind of caught not worshiping this is going to be thrown into a burning, fiery furnace. It says in Daniel 3, there are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. You tell everyone to bow down, hey, listen, they don't care. They're like, we hear you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready to, when you hear the sound of the horns and the pipe and the lyre and the trigon and harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace, and who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? They answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. We don't know the exact steps, what happened, but here's where my worry and anxiety starts to kick in. The expression of Nebuchadnezzar's face even changes, it says. And he ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind them and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Now, if you're Shadrach, Meshach, or Abednego, you know, imagine even someone said, hey, I'm just going to tell you, you're going to go into that furnace, man. I'm sorry. Like, if you're thinking that God is going to preserve you from going into it, like there's a workaround, it's not going to happen. Imagine what they would have thought. Certainly they thought it was the end. Certainly they thought they were being faithful unto death. Everyone could imagine how God could miraculously perhaps, you know, make everyone turn every brother's sword against them, and all of a sudden Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego walk out, right? We see examples of that in the Old Testament. Not what happens. They know they're going literally into the fire. These men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, their garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. And do you think that they were like wrapped up real delicately? Oh, make sure you don't get rope burn. Okay, that's not too tight on you, is it? Okay. They were roughed up, almost certainly. But because the king's order was so urgent, basically the fire was so hot, the flames killed some of the guys who were putting them in there. And they fell bound. They didn't walk because they were bound, right? They fell bound into the furnace. Imagine you right there. What goes through your mind? What does God's manna look like for the next 5 minutes? Well, here's what it looked like. It looked like grace for that day, in that moment, in that time. Then King Nebuchadnezzar, astonished, he rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire? They answered and said to the king, true, O king, you are correct. He answered and said, but I see 4 men unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. The fire had not any power over their bodies. The hairs on their heads were not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon him. What do we see exemplified here? Do we see exemplified necessarily that God will deliver you out of every trial? No. Oh, I already put it up there. God's promise for tomorrow is not, don't worry, that won't happen, but don't worry, if you draw near to me, tomorrow's grace will outmatch tomorrow's devastation. Remember, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they weren't priests. priests were the only people who experienced the direct presence of God. Right? In that way, you can't miss the fact that it was in the fire where they had the most direct, unmediated, incredible, sustaining exposure to the presence of God in there, in the furnace itself. Yes, they were delivered from the flames, but they were preserved in the flames in a way that no one could have ever imagined. They were sitting up having a prayer circle before they were about to be thrown in there. No one's idea would have been, you know what's going to happen? There's going to, you know, God is going to appear in there with us and walk around in the fire. No one would have thought that, but it doesn't matter because we don't have to be able to imagine how God's grace is going to show up tomorrow. But guess what? It's only going to come tomorrow. So don't be afraid. So don't be afraid. The fiery furnace leads us to the second point, which I'm going to have to back up for. And that is the power of empathetic presence. The power of empathetic presence. Jesus promises us in Matthew 28 that he will be with us always. Always, always, always. God has promised to be with us and in us. The Spirit is with you, but he will be in you. Jesus tells his disciples. And that means that the incorporeal, meaning the non-physical, presence of Jesus and the Spirit are no less real than our hands or our feet. Now, we talked about this when we were talking about shame, when everyone's making the Christian jokes in your corporate meeting, and you feel like, you know, you're sitting there sinking down in your chair, and you don't want to say anything. Now, what if Jesus, you turn around, instead of your supervisor sitting there, it was Jesus Christ in the flesh. Now all of a sudden, you're going to change your tune a little bit. Now all of a sudden, instead of feeling like you're all apologetic and all the rest and embarrassed because you're a Christian or whatever it may be, and I'm not saying that that's what you would feel like, but for some of us, sometimes, you know, you don't want to be necessarily straightforward about it because of you're afraid of feeling that way, feeling like outside the camp, perhaps in the workplace. Hey, but if Jesus showed up, even if no one else could see him, you could see him. And Jesus just went like this, hey man, I'm here. You can stand strong. That changes things. The presence of God changes things. Because we cannot see Jesus and his angels as ministering spirits to us, it feels like they're not really there. It feels like the person standing next to me. It seems to me that Glenn is more here than Jesus is. Of course, that's not the case. We convince ourselves, you know what, if Jesus showed up in bodily form right here and he promised to walk around with me the rest of my life, okay, then I could really take a sigh of relief. That wouldn't be him being any closer than he is now. That's what I'm saying. Here's this goofy example on the side. This comes from the realm, partly science, partly metaphysics of space and time. Has anyone seen the movie Flatland? Okay, good. So I'm the only super nerd in here. That's good for you, I think. This is my favorite way of picturing the presence of God. Okay? You see this little design here? It's flat, isn't it? And in the movie Flatland, these little people exist in only two dimensions. They have forward and back, and they have right and left. And that's it. And if you watch the movie Flatland, these really funny things will happen. So like this little flat person is going in here and they've kind of put this person in prison in this room. Well, what happens is someone like this man here who exists, who has another dimension, he comes in and he picks one of them up out of the room. And from the Flatlander's perspective, he disappears. You see how that would work? I mean, if you can only see this way and this way, you don't have any even concept of this. It doesn't even exist. And all of a sudden, this man comes and picks somebody up. It would literally look to that person like they disappeared in front of their eyes. But did they really go anywhere, so to speak? They didn't. They're right there, here. Just like this man. He could stick out his hand and be right there, closer than most of you want to be to another human being, right here. But you couldn't see him. I fear that we think of Jesus and even angels like often some spirit world. And God's presence among us is kind of like a metaphor. And what I want to suggest is, I'm not saying that this is how it happens in reality. Okay, I don't know how God does it. But what I want to suggest is it's much closer to something like this and much less to something like something so ethereal and something so almost unreal, less real, less substantive. No. It's more substantive. It's like the grass that Lewis talks about, right? In The Great Divorce, the grass there wasn't less real. It was like it was more real. This person exists in an extra dimension, not one less. The fact that these little flatlanders can't discern that doesn't make him any less real. What I want to suggest is something similar. Okay, just as a way, if that helps you wrap your mind around it. In fact, in the movie, they play this up real good because they have Mr. Line, who can only see backwards and forwards, right? And then like the person who has the second dimension comes in and like takes something off his line, and it looks like it disappears. Anyways, go watch it if you really want to waste an hour of your life. But it provides, I think, a very helpful picture of how someone, and you're saying, well, wait a second, are you telling me that God could be? It's like, no, we only you can't even think about it. There's only three dimensions here. My point is that, I don't want to keep talking about it because it'll get too nerdy and irrelevant. But the point is that this is a model. I want you to think about God's presence as not something that is off in a spirit land, something like that, but is real and is with us in a way that we can't know because we're not God. Because this is what we know. We know three dimensions and time. Who knows what God knows? How he operates. He authored all of it. What I want to suggest is God is closer to you than the people sitting next to you in this room right now, and it's not overly spiritual. But not only that, Christ's suffering allows his presence to be empathetic, and this is so important. He knows what it's like to have deep anxiety so that you don't have to. Remembered sweating drops of blood in the garden. Anxiety. It's always interesting to me when people who have anxiety try to justify it by pointing at like that scenario. See, I was like, okay, have you prepared to endure the wrath of God recently? You haven't? Oh, okay. Jesus endured the wrath of God so you wouldn't have to. He had the deepest fear possible so that perfect love could cast out fear. And so Jesus, who is present with us always, really, truly, robustly, can say, hey, I know what deep fear is like, but I'm here. I'm with you. Hey, I won't leave you. I'll be with you in the furnace. If things get really bad, if push comes to shove, I'll take you home with me. But I'm here. I'm here. Help people understand the presence, the empathetic presence of God. I'll make one final point here. It's related to the fiery furnace. This is kind of one of those zingers that you can take with you and remember. At least it is for me. What is far more important to us to cling on to is the promise of God's presence and not the exact details of his provision. What we need to cling to is the promise of his presence, not the details of his provision, how exactly he's going to work things out. What matters is he'll be there with you, really, truly, through it. Not a hair falls from your head without him being the author of it. So help people understand the empathetic presence of God. And let me just be honest with you. This is going to connect with some people more than others. Some people just have a really difficult time. Like I don't know. I feel like this may not be true. I mean, at least it feels in this moment. So maybe I'm guilty of emotional reasoning here. But I feel like people who are more imaginative or more emotional, this seems to be more helpful for. And people who aren't, it's not as much. I don't know. It seems like there's a different level of connection. That's fine. But just but for everybody, it's equally true no matter your temperament or your disposition. The empathetic presence of God, I am with you. I am in this with you. Okay? So we got the manna principle. Did I just mess this up? No, I didn't. Okay. We have the manna principle, and we have a presence of God. Third, I'm going to have to skip back over this next slide. I apologize. I changed these up in my manuscript, and I messed up sending it over to Susan. The necessity of felt dependence. Notice that word felt is not in italics like it is on mine. Notice the non-italicized felt that should be italicized there on the screen. The necessity of felt dependence. Because again, everyone in here would say, hey, are you dependent on God?
Yes.
Okay? So that's not what we're talking about. What is felt dependence? What is felt dependence? How do you help someone experience that? Okay? Two things you need to understand about the dynamics of worriers first. Okay? First, worriers crave control. I've tried the promises of God and they didn't help my anxiety, but what would work is if I had the kind of power and control that God has. Because then what do? I back out the last element of that formula, don't I? The impotence piece. You know what would really work? Like if someone came alongside and said, okay, Tyler, if I could give you something right now that would take away your anxiety, what would it be? Power. If I was like omnipotent right now, I promise I could get things done so that I wouldn't have to worry about what I'm worrying about. I want control. Now, the label of a control freak generally is reserved for someone who's this like neurotic micromanager of every segment of their life. But here's the thing. People who worry constantly are control freaks. It's just in more narrow lanes. Okay, maybe they don't care about how the kitchen looks or how the paint on the walls as much or whatever. But when it comes to these specific things, they're as control freak as you get. And guess what? When they don't have control, there comes the anxiety. I need to be able to control this. It needs to be under my power. I need to be able to do something about it. Otherwise, I'm just kind of at the whims. I'm a leaf floating down the river, and I'm just waiting to get smacked by something. No, I need to have control. I need structure. I need to be able to impose my will on things. But what is a craving for control other than a desire for greater power or less impotence? That's what it is. I want more. I want more control. I want to be able to do more, to affect more. I crave not being weak in this world. But what's so interesting, in the context is a little bit different because it's talking about him being kept from pride. But listen to what Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. He's been caught up into third heaven, which is the presence of God. And so to keep me from becoming conceited because of the surpassing greatness of the revelation, which, I mean, imagine that, being ushered into the throne room of God. A thorn was given me in the flesh, which, by the way, brothers and sisters, is not a besetting sin. I've had a couple people say that justify their sin by appealing to this. Well, even Paul had a thorn. That's not what Paul is talking about, okay? Paul is not talking about God gave him a pet sin that he couldn't get rid of and was okay with it because it kept him humble. No, that's just not what it's saying. There's scholarly discussions here, but it's either a messenger of Satan, some people interpret it literally like some kind of demonic presence that kept annoying him, or it was a physical impediment. Some people think it's his eyes. See at the end of Galatians, look how large letters I use right in my own hand, whatever it is. But it's not all of a sudden he got some kind of sinful struggle that he didn't already have already. Three times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, whether this is a demonic thing, whether this is his eyes, some kind of physical ailment, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. And then verse 10 is the most shocking countercultural part of the whole passage. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content. That's the last word I would ever expect to come here, given what he's about to say. He's not, I am committed, not, I am faithful, not, I am pressing on. I am content with weakness, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Whoa! Now that is big time right there. That is not how we think. That's not, at least it's not how I think. Perhaps it's how you think. Paul says, no. I know that I understand my own impotence. He describes it again. We already talked about it as a jar of clay here. I have limited ability to do things. I have limited strength. I'm relatively fragile. But guess what? That's where God's power shows up the most. So can you help somebody boast in their weakness so that God can show his power through them instead of trying to gain more and more of it? Instead of trying to gain more and more and more control, to manage things tighter, to screw down every single possible loose end, can you trust him and say, hey, you're never going to be able to do that anyways. You're never going to be able to do that anyways. Can God's power, can Christ's power be made perfect in this person's weakness, or is it something that they're always feeling ashamed of and guilty for because they're looking to the next person, seeing how they're doing it better than them? Can you help the power of God be displayed in someone's weakness? This first thing, worriers crave control. Here's the second thing worriers do. Worriers trust in planning. Crave control, and they trust in their planning. Ultimate trust here. I'm not talking about just secondary, tertiary trust. I've tried the promises of God, and they didn't help my anxiety. But what would help is if I could have the kind of knowledge that God has so I could prepare. Okay, so the impotence piece, fair enough. Okay, if you can't give me that, here's what I want. I want more knowledge. More knowledge of the future so that I can get ready, even if it's possible options. So worriers often place their real faith, and that's the key point here, their real faith in contingency planning under the disguise of being responsible. You always hear this, you always hear the qualifiers. And here's the thing, planning oftentimes is responsible. This isn't a matter of not planning, it's a matter of where your heart is. It's a matter of where your trust is. It's a matter of where your security is. Worriers often place their real faith, what they really sigh relief for, in contingency planning under the disguise of being responsible. Luke chapter 12, and when they bring you before the synagogues and rulers and authorities, do not be anxious about how you should defend yourself or what you should say, for the Holy Spirit will teach you in that very hour what you ought to say. Again, there's the manna principle again, right? When are you going to get that? In that hour. Well, what about while I'm walking up the steps and I don't know what I'm going to say and I get right here, boom! Then the Lord will provide it for you is what he's saying. But what about preparing? I could get a catalog of responses ready if you at least let me know what kinds of things might happen. Then I could at least have a good framework to fall back on. And again, obviously, plenty of times where planning is responsible. I hope people plan responsibly, are good stewards, make wise decisions. That's not the issue. The issue is where your heart finds its real security. Calvin sums it up this way in the Institutes. Listen to how he says it in the way that only he can. Now, regarding all the aids, the means, the things that we could go do, contingency plans, that's what he's talking about when he says aids. Regarding all the aids which the creatures can lend himself as hands offered by the Lord, he will avail himself of them as the legitimate instruments of divine providence. And as he is uncertain what the results of any business in which he engages is to be, he will zealously aim for what he deems for the best, so far as his abilities enable him. He'll be responsible. However, confidence in external aids will not be such that the presence of them will make him feel secure, meaning ultimately secure, and the absence of them fill him with dismay as if he were destitute. His mind will always be fixed on the providence of God alone, and no consideration of present circumstances will be allowed to withdraw him from the steady contemplation of it. What Calvin is saying in so many words is this: be responsible, plan, make good choices, but make sure that that's not where your security is in. And if you're a worrier, most worriers are contingency planners, and that's where they breed their truest sighs of relief when they have a plan together. Either way, worry thrives on ignorance, doesn't it? Either way, worry thrives on ignorance. Because of this, worriers need help trusting God for only the next step, not the shape of the staircase. That's what a worrier wants to see. I'm on this step, and there's a wall in front of me, okay? And when I was on the last step, there was a wall in front of me there, and when the wall moved, I was able to take one more step. Hey, I want to see how many steps are in this staircase and what the landing looks like up there. Okay? That's what I want to see. I want to see the end right now. I don't want the wall to move one more step and me to step one more step. I want to see the whole thing. I want to see the shape of the staircase. And what worriers need is they need help taking the next step. And that is where God will always give the grace. And that's where people need to live. In fact, maybe you could say it this way. You need to help worriers be better reactors than they are futurists. One step. Okay, what's next? It's the next step. Well, what's next? Oh, man, this is devastating. How do we respond to devastation? The difference between that model and the model where you see right here is I worry, and I worry, and I worry, and I worry, and here's the thing, the same devastation comes. You see that? The same thing happens. The difference in the first model is that this person isn't worried, at least not in the same way. How can you help people respond? How can you show them how God's grace meets them in the fire? Because worry thrives on ignorance. Help people see the next step, the next day. Sometimes, brothers and sisters, it's the next 30 minutes or the next hour instead of the whole staircase. So help people break down life into smaller pieces when considering how to process things when things are in danger. And instead of trying to predict the future, which we're going to talk about in just a second, help them respond to adversity and challenges when they come instead of living like there is always a fire on the next stair. Help worriers learn to experience dependence on God. They are dependent on him whether they feel like it or not. Here's where you really get the felt part. Felt dependence. In him we live and we move and we have our being. We live and we move and we have our being. Regardless of whether you or anyone else believes that you are depending on God to sustain you or not, you are. It's a myth that there are things that you ultimately trust God for and then you kind of ultimately do yourself. Right? And God kind of takes care of these things in your life, and then kind of you take care of these things over here. If he's both creator and sustainer, and he's sovereign in the way we talk about, then we're dependent on God for everything, not just when you need a miracle to happen. Not just when you need a miracle to happen. Here's what happens. What we forget is the reality of preventative dependence. What is preventative dependence? Do you think that your great driving skills were ultimately the reason you got here today? Were your great driving skills ultimately the reason that you drove here safely today? No, they were not. I hope you have great driving skills. And I hope you are committed to driving best practices. But ultimately, what got you here safe today was God's providence. Is your exercise regime and healthy eating ultimately what's keeping you healthy without disease? I hope you are eating healthy and exercising. But guess what? So was Ryan Boomershine's friend that all of y'all heard about and could be praying about. Healthy guy, running all the time, physical devastation. This is not the guy this is supposed to happen to. This is supposed to happen to the person who lives a sedentary lifestyle, eats potato chips, and watches TV. Not this kind of guy. So do you think that your healthy eating choices and your physical exercise is ultimately the reason you're enjoying the health you're enjoying? No, it's not. What about your heart continuing to beat through this Sunday school class? What about that tornado missing your house but hitting the one next to it? Were you dependent on God this week to not find one of your children with infant leukemia? You probably weren't. I wasn't. And here's why. Because regularity often leads to the myth of independence. Here's what happens. Patterns start building up. Patterns start developing. You know? This didn't happen. This didn't happen. This didn't happen. This didn't happen. I'm praying to God for these things over here, like maybe my marriage or maybe my whatever it is, my job situation. And where God is really doing most of the work is in the specific things that I'm praying for. These things over here just kind of happen. I'm desperately dependent on God to help my marriage, not so desperately dependent on God to drive to work. Think your job is secure because is your job secure because of how well that you have performed? No, it is not. It is not, because you could be caught tomorrow in some kind of scheme where you are blackmailed and blackballed out of your company, and now you don't have a job because some greedy exec wants you gone. Oh, I can't imagine that happening. It happens. I read about a story just this morning about a man who was in a market in Japan with his son standing. They were just standing there, playing together. He was standing. He lost his balance, fell over, and he broke his son's neck and killed him. What are you ultimately, do you understand that the Lord prevents those kinds of things from happening all the time too? And I can tell you so many times where the Lord has prevented things, and I've gotten little glimpses of to what he probably prevents all the time. Like bullets flying past my head in this life, spiritual bullets, social bullets, financial bullets, physical safety bullets. And I'm just kind of like going through it. And if you can get someone to understand that regularity doesn't mean less dependence, regularity doesn't mean less dependence, then all of a sudden the question, if God is doing this every second, and he's working every single moment and every single day, then the question, well, I wonder if he'll show up tomorrow, starts to fade away. What do you mean? He wonders he's going to show up tomorrow. He showed up. You didn't fall over and die like Ted Chrisman did. Godliest, one of the godliest men that Stephen has ever known, right? Health issues. Lord took him to be home. But my wife had a friend who had a little boy. They were cooking in the kitchen, and he just fell over dead, y'all. He had a congenital heart failure. God prevents those things. So taking them for granted is going to make you really surprised when these kinds of things happen. But if you're constantly helping someone understand, hey, it is the Lord that got me here today. It is the Lord that sustains my heartbeat. It is the Lord that ultimately is responsible for these things. Worry starts to fade about these acute issues, these specific things that we tend to think that somehow God shows up more for than for other things. So help people feel their dependence on God. Not just know it, but accept it, so that they understand how out of control their life really is on a daily basis. Help people understand how out of their control their life is on a daily basis, even if they think that they've got things really under control. Felt dependence. Finally, for today, worriers are false prophets. Of course, a little bit poetic. I don't mean prophet in the sense of, you know, they're a real prophet like Isaiah or something. But this insight comes from Ed Welch, one of my favorite counselors. He talks about the idea of worriers being false prophets. In Deuteronomy 18, you kind of see what happens if you're someone who tries to predict the future or potential outcomes and are wrong. You're done. You're a false prophet. He uses this as a little bit of a paradigm for helping come alongside people who tend to worry. And he talks about worriers are people because worry lives in the future of what is going to happen, what may happen, what might not happen. He classifies worriers as, I guess, again, figuratively speaking, false prophets. Worriers predict the future with startling inaccuracy. Their track record is awful. And yet, they still hold their predictions in high regard, changing behaviors, feelings, and thought patterns because of them. So remember, we talked about the difference between believing something and then kind of accepting it, if you'll allow the somewhat artificial distinction there, such that it actually informs how you live life. This is the opposite. These people don't know what's going to happen, but they accept things pragmatically. I'm accepting it. I'm letting it dominate my thought life. I'm changing my behaviors. Well, what if it doesn't happen? Well, then I'll have prepared for nothing, I guess. That's the idea. In Israel, if you claim to be a faithful prophet and made a false prophecy, you are done. So, but it's not so with worriers. One author discusses it like this. This is just so insightful. Often worriers believe they have a heightened sense of discernment of danger and possibilities than other people. They believe themselves to be more careful thinkers, considering options for the future and their probabilities that other people are either not bright enough or not alert enough to recognize. Thus, often, in their mind, their ministry of worry is a gift to people who otherwise might fall headlong into potential danger that often never materializes. Okay. And you might think that after a while, with a track record of worrying about this happening and it doesn't happen, I'm worried about this happening and it doesn't happen, I'm worried about this happening and it doesn't happen, I'm thinking this is going to happen and it doesn't happen, you might think that they would give up. But as this author goes on to say, worriers are worse at discerning the future than the weatherman is at predicting snow. The difference is that despite their horrible track record, worriers tend to believe that they are more competent predictors than the weatherman, and therefore their predictions must be given proper respect as credible concerns. I'm worried about this. Worried about that. Worried about this over here. Worried that this might happen. When my kid's in a wreck, he didn't text me back. What if his phone turns off? His phone has just turned off because he's in the movie. No, he's probably in a ditch somewhere. Worriers deeply respect their own speculations and demand that you do too. Okay, let me take a line out of Tyler's Book of Failures here. Tell someone who's worrying about something that what they're worrying about is just silly and see how well that works. Let me give you a hint, not well. Okay? Because of this right here. Worriers deeply respect their own speculations and demand that you do so too. Hey, I'm not some, what are you saying? You're not respect, what do you think, I'm some loony? You're not taking what I'm serious here. I'm thoughtfully considering things and it sounds like you're disrespecting my speculations. So how do you move forward there? Well, what you do is you help worriers confront their predictive inadequacy. And let me just say that this requires a ton of humility on the part of the person who is being confronted, so to speak. Did anyone see the movie A Beautiful Mind? Beautiful Mind. Couple people. Okay. If you haven't seen the movie Beautiful Mind, it follows Ronald Nash, an incredible mathematician. He came up with Nash Equilibrium. But hopefully a lot of you know, he had schizophrenia. And the movie shows him, as a schizophrenic man, with his wife, and he's a paranoid schizophrenic. He thinks people are after him. He thinks he's getting hired to do things and solve codes for the government and all the rest. He's not really, though. It's all part of his delusion, right? It's all part of his schizophrenia. Well, his wife has about had it because it's been pointed out to him in the past that a lot of this stuff isn't real. And they go back and he says, well, he was out with his college roommate. And they're like, you know, according to all the dorm records, he lived alone. And all of a sudden, this thing starts to unfold and you get in the position watching this movie like, wait, maybe I don't know what's real or not, which is why the movie is so well done. He gets to a point where he forgets the, I believe it's in the same scene, where he has a newborn son or daughter, is totally zoned out and leaves them in the water, giving them a bath, just totally checked out. Wife had enough, gets out in the car, is running out there, because he just keeps going back to that these things are real, and that what he's seeing and what he's thinking is actually reality. And he puts his hands on the hood of the car, and he's like, no, 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 wait, I finally admit it. And she says she never grows older. She never ages. What he's talking about is this girl that keeps popping up in his delusions. And it dawned on him, and he was convinced she was real, but it's been happening for so long. What he realized is, wait a second, if this were real, she wouldn't look the same after 15 years. Finally, he was like, oh my goodness, you're right. All of this is a delusion. I'm missing reality here. And then he begins to have this turnaround. I don't want to suggest that someone who worries is schizophrenic. Okay, that's not the application. But what someone will have to come to terms with is this. This has to do with much more than just anxiety and worry. Someone is going to have to come to terms with, I get reality wrong a lot. I interpret life wrong a lot. And it's hard for me to admit that because I am just as confident in my interpretation of things and relationships and events and happenings and the why behind it. I am just as convinced of those as just about anything, but I have to admit, it's been pointed out so many times that this has been wrong that I need someone to help me think clearly about some of these things. I need some help thinking clearly. I need some outside eyes and ears. And I need some people to come in and say, hey, I know it feels like this. I know it seems like this. I know you are firmly convinced of this, but let me just say, it's not. That allows you to help someone not let potential false prophecies dominate their life. Okay? And then you can start finding where is this person's beliefs false and their thinking distorted. We've talked about this ad nauseum, so we won't go into it, because we've talked about looking again at the distorted thinking. But because worry does not speak the language of logic, this strategy cannot be used in isolation from the others. Okay? Worry and fear do not speak the language of logic. They just don't. It's the wrong antidote for the wrong cure by itself. Nevertheless, helping anxious people challenge their thoughts is extremely important. And that's what we need to do. We need to help people. I say help people. I hope throughout this series it's been pretty well worked in that it's not just like other people. We all tend to do this. We have seasons of life too where we're just, man, I just can't think straight. I'm interpreting this relationship wrong. I'm returning this. I need to just kind of outsource my reasoning to some other folks, okay? I've done this before and it's been very refreshing. I feel this way, but I've heard this. It's like a totally different than what I think is actually going on, man. Find some people that you trust and say, tell me how it is. Tell me how it is. I know you love me. Tell me how it is. Help people not be false prophets. When we come back next time, we'll close out anxiety and perhaps our series together. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, these are challenging things. These are nothing more, however, than examples of your wisdom and your grace fleshed out in our lives. We pray that you would help us cling to these, even when they're difficult, to consult wise counselors, to trust that you will be there, that you will provide for tomorrow, but only when tomorrow comes, Lord, and to live for today in the grace that you have provided. Thank you for new mercies. Thank you for sustaining us as you have. We are so grateful, even though we are often thankless for it. Be with us in our break, in our next service. May our worship be a pleasing aroma to you. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.